Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series Power Tool Accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Troy Senek. His new book, A Man of Iron, is the story of Grover Cleveland, the 22nd and 24th president of the United States. You notice there's something in between. That's because Grover Cleveland was three times a candidate for the presidency. He won the popular vote all three times, but the second time he lost in the Electoral College. Why did he lose? Why is a man who's been celebrated his whole life, as Troy writes, he's not for turning, which we say of Margaret Thatcher, we say that of Grover Cleveland. Why was he rejected in the election of 1888? We go immediately to the policies that dominate the conversation. We mentioned the Grand Army of the Republic rebuking Grover Cleveland for not handing out the pensions that are brought by senators and congressmen as a form of, well, the graft is too strong a word, favors. However, we come to his thinking about America as the frontier is closing. And I want to start there because you mentioned, Troy, that he denounces Geronimo as a murderous savage. I thought, Geronimo in Grover Cleveland's life? Good heavens. What was Grover Cleveland's opinion for the least among us, the Native Americans and the African Americans, and also for the people who were homesteading in America? Let's begin with the Native Americans, the indigenous people. What was his attitude about their challenges?
He has what we would now regard as a fairly righteous attitude about the way that Native Americans have been mistreated by the federal government. He singles them out in his inaugural address and reproaches the country for the way that they've been treated in the past. And he makes one of the objectives of his first term trying to set Native Americans on better footing. The practical implications of this is he signs something known as the Dawes Act. And the idea here is that Cleveland thinks as the frontier is closing, that it is unsustainable to continue this sort of one country, two systems model where you've got the United States moving ever westward, but Native Americans confined to the reservation system. And he is trying to put them on a footing where they can embrace private property, where they can become American citizens, where they can have voting rights. It is very well intentioned, but there is many a slip twixt the cup and the lip here. And over the years, during Cleveland's terms and afterwards, we will see these policies get distorted and changed in lots of ways that end up injuring Native American populations. Things like the government officials out west who are supposed to help them make this transition, making sure that those officials themselves get the good slices of land and the Native Americans don't. So he cares deeply about this, although he is in the end unable to make as much of a difference on the policy side as he would have liked to.
He's a Democrat. He represents the what was at one time the slaveocracy, the Confederacy. The Solid South is a major part of his success in 1884 and again in 1892. How did he treat the segregationists in his party? What did he make of them because of their arrogance?
The way that he fits in relationship to that strain of the party is a little difficult for us to understand in the modern era because it doesn't really satisfy any of our pre-existing mental categories, by which I mean Cleveland comes to office the first Democrat elected after the Civil War. So there are concerns in parts of the country, especially amongst the freedmen, that this could mean we're going back to slavery. Those kind of rumors are running around the country. And Cleveland goes out of his way in his inaugural address to make plain that black citizenship is an immutable fact of American life and that they are not going back. He does things in his personal capacity in the White House along these lines too, that make him unpopular within the Democratic Party, such as having Frederick Douglass, at the time with Frederick Douglass's white wife, over to the White House for social occasions with some regularity, angers a lot of other Democrats. But once again, when it comes to the actual policy, Cleveland falls short here. Cleveland opposes the Republican efforts. This is especially going into his third election in 1892 to interpose the federal government in the South to rectify the problem of blacks not having the right to vote. And I should say that there is no evidence that any of this is driven by racial animus. You don't really see a bigoted bone in his body at any point in his life, even though he's not what we would consider today a thoroughgoing racial egalitarian. It comes from this deep and immovable sense of constitutionalism. He cannot get his head around the idea that the only solution to this would be to invade the rights that rightfully belong to the states under the 10th Amendment to conduct their elections the way that they would want.
The Chinese Exclusion Act, the protectionism is part of it, but the Chinese were badly treated, especially because they were working some of the most dangerous jobs, the Union Pacific, the mining. What is his opinion of the way that the Congress treats the Chinese? Represent a lot of Asians who are coming to America this time. What is his opinion of those bills?
You know, this is interesting. This is another area where his position would make nobody in the modern context satisfied, by which I mean, so he inherits the Chinese Exclusion Act. That happens in the Arthur administration, but they get even more restrictive in the Cleveland administration, mostly in terms of not letting people who had been in the U.S. and gone back home return to the U.S. And the reason for this, there's a lot of violence towards Chinese workers, especially there's a terrible massacre in Wyoming, which I chronicle in the book, in which Cleveland sends in federal troops. He is outraged, actually, by the fact that racial prejudice seems to be driving these attacks. But he nevertheless comes to the conclusion that the tensions, the racial tensions that exist with this immigrant community are beyond his capacity to rectify. So in the small universe of difference that he can make, he thinks, okay, we probably actually have to separate out these immigrant communities. We have to actually restrict the flow in, because what we have seen over and over again is that it results in violence. So he is simultaneously abhorring the racism that's driving this, but also coming to the conclusion that really all we can do here is restrict the inflow, because it leads to so much tension and it leads to so much violence.
Bimetallism. It's time to turn to a policy that is an antique. At the same time, it makes sense. The silver wing of the Republican and Democratic Party, because it wasn't straight up partisanship, and the gold wing. Can we explain it quickly, Troy?
Yeah, we can. The country was on the gold standard at this point. There had been a limited use of silver added to the money supply. And really all the layperson needs to understand about this is that the push for silver was largely driven by a concern that people, particularly in the South and the West, had amassed so much debt in moving out to the frontier that silver, because it would have an inflationary effect, would have the practical consequence of reducing the felt burden of that debt. And that is, those are really the terms on which this debate is happening as a political matter. If you are pushing for more silver, it is usually because you are pushing to lessen the debt burden of people on the frontier or in the South.
And that will stain the reelection bid, because his party is not entirely supportive of him anymore. He doesn't see, as the party does, that a part of the party, that if you can pay your debts with a silver dollar, though it's worth 85% of a gold dollar, or maybe 72%, it bounces back and forth,
right,
it will ease your debt burden. That, of course, is instability, which to a classical liberal is a fire alarm. Do I say that correctly, Troy?
You do. And as I mentioned in the book, too, I think because he is a lawyer, the thing that is so inflammatory to him about this is that if you are changing the terms in which everything is denominated, you are changing the terms of every long-term contract in the country. And for a classical liberal and a lawyer, that is something he just can't get his head around.
I celebrate him for a small piece of the first term. This is his attempt to regulate nature and the what we would call ecology today. The National Forest Reserve. It's not Yellowstone yet, but it's headed that way. The reason I mention this in particular, there's so many weighty issues here in that first term. It really is the challenge of America over the next century or more. Into the 21st century, these issues can't be resolved. But the massacre of wildlife out west, Troy, when you see the scale of it, you puzzle to yourself. Yeah. And he was thinking as a hunter and as a fisherman that this needs to be preserved. Did he write extensively about it?
He didn't write extensively about it, partially because he didn't write extensively about anything. But the only book that we have in his hand was a book that he wrote about his hunting and fishing pastimes. And in that book, it is really the pastimes qua pastimes. He is not talking about their implications for policy like this, except there is a passage which I quote in my book where he says that anybody who is animated by the true spirit of sportsmanship when you're hunting or fishing understands that you have to carefully self-regulate. It can't be this wanton destruction of wildlife. And that is one of the things that motivates this sort of conservationist spirit that we see in him. It's a minor theme throughout his administration, but it does remind us that this goes back a little further than Theodore Roosevelt, which is where most people usually start that story.
I'm glad you mentioned Roosevelt because he's coming back, but there is a moment in the governor's mansion in Albany when Roosevelt wants a bill passed and Grover Cleveland rebukes him. How does he do it? It's quite spectacular, Troy.
Cleveland, who actually agreed with the substance of this bill, just Roosevelt had drafted it sloppily, and Cleveland's a good lawyer, so he can't have that, told him he was going to veto it, and Cleveland brings his fist down. This was a signature move of his. Brings his fist down, pounds his desk, informs him, "Mr. Roosevelt, I will veto this bill." And Roosevelt is recorded to have fallen backwards in his chair. I think fair to say that there are not many people who could have gotten that reaction out of Teddy Roosevelt. And one of Cleveland's staffers records that every time he sees these two go back and forth, it's a friendly relationship, generally speaking, but that he can't help but think of a great mastiff and a little terrier.
Every great man grows up with a great man in his imagination he wants to please. And your book reveals to me that I believe Teddy Roosevelt wanted to please Grover Cleveland.
I think there's something to that.
That explains a deal of his, what we now call ecology. The question of silver and gold will come back. However, the defeat is a surprise. He is defeated by a man he respects, however, Benjamin Harrison. What do we need to know about this defeat, Troy?
We need to know that it's close, for one thing. As you mentioned, Cleveland wins the popular vote here. This is really decided by two states, Indiana and New York, and the margins were very small. That's point one. Point two that you probably need to know is that there were allegations that this election was stolen from Grover Cleveland because of the margins. Amongst the people who did not believe that was Grover Cleveland, who, when asked what he thought had happened, said, "I think the other party got the most votes." He was not willing to entertain this. And the third thing you need to know is that Cleveland really did himself in here in some sense, by which I mean he decided to build his entire reelection campaign around the issue of tariff reduction. Deeply felt, this was a principle that was part of both of his administrations, but a deep political miscalculation because, as you suggested earlier with the monetary policy issue, this issue did not unite his party. So the idea of going into a presidential reelection, building the entire thing around an issue that splits your party down the middle, not the best political strategy in the world, to such an extent that we know that the men who managed Grover Cleveland's campaign were not terribly disappointed that he lost. That's how divisive it was within the party.
The book is A Man of Iron, The Turbulent Life and Improbable Presidency of Grover Cleveland. Troy Senek is the author. When we come back, Cleveland at Home. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.